Apple, McDonald's, Southwest Airlines, General Electric.
How healthy are America's big companies, and what does it mean for the economy?
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for downloading the podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, April 21st.
Coming up, we'll look at corporate earnings.
We'll find out why the housing market remains sluggish despite an economic rebound.
Also, Russia is going to start paying big money for its citizens to have kids.
And breaking news, there's some new exciting Slurpee technology.
Slurpee technology.
That's right.
Those stories and more are just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is brought to you by FreshBooks. For small business owners, FreshBooks is the online invoicing service to help you track time and expenses, create and send invoices, and receive payments. Accounts are free to manage up to 3 clients. To learn more, visit FreshBooks.com.
Okay, let's get to corporate earnings season. Lots of numbers this morning from General Electric, United Continental, McDonald's, Apple, which reported late yesterday. Diane Swank is off this week. We're joined instead by her colleague at Mesirow Financial, Adolfo Laurenti. He is the deputy chief economist there, and he's with us now from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's start, Adolfo, with the tech sector, because that has really been the big story of the earnings season so far. Apple says its profits more than doubled last quarter.
Yes, there are two factors going on in the technology sector. So first of all, consumers are willing to spend. It's not true for many other goods, but with the new mobile telephone, the tablets, the e-book readers on the market, consumer spending seems to be relatively more solid in this field than other areas. And then there is the stories of business spending. Companies have been delaying investment for quite some time, but now it's the time to spend for hardware, for software. And this is reflecting through the market and through positive earnings results that we are seeing in these days.
Okay, and on the other hand, we've got airlines that are not doing so well. Even Southwest Airlines reported a 55% drop in profit. United Continental says they have seen a loss in the last quarter.
Costs are really rising. The energy prices that are haunting all of us are really bad for airlines because the jet fuel cost almost one-third of their overall cost. So it's very difficult for them to pass these price increases because it's a very competitive field. One solution might be to cut on capacity, so I'm afraid we are going to be cramped on those economy seats during the summer, but it's very, very difficult to make, you know, the numbers look good right now. Costs are up, prices cannot go up, they are squeezed.
Okay, and finally and quickly, what about McDonald's? They saw a 10% rise in profit. What do you make of that?
Well, in part is a story of growth abroad, but there is also what we economists call the substitution effect. Many people cannot go and cook for themselves because maybe they are working two jobs, maybe they are traveling. So they need to go and eat out. And these fast food chains really offers a cheap alternative to local restaurants. You can still have your meal, you save some money, and that's a good business for a fast food chain.
Adolfo Laurenti, Deputy Chief Economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, a jury could start deliberating as soon as today in a high-profile insider trading case on Wall Street, the case of Raj Rajaratnam, the founder of the Galleon Group hedge fund. He's accused of using insider information to make money. But what will the case mean for how business is done in the future on Wall Street? Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Whether or not Raj Rajaratnam is convicted, his case has gotten people paying attention to insider trading again. Robert Heim is a lawyer who used to work at the Securities and Exchange Commission. He says that's part of what prosecutors wanted to do with this case.
The SEC and the prosecutors have really intended to show that insider trading cases are back at the top of the agenda.
There have been plenty of high-profile insider cases in the past. Think Ivan Boesky or Martha Stewart. The question is whether those cases deter somebody considering a life of white-collar crime. Seth Taub is head of litigation for Baker Botts, which is a law firm. He used to work in the enforcement department at the SEC. He has a cynical take.
The deterrent effect lasts for a year or two, and then the next generation of 30-somethings who think they're the smartest guys in the room come up with new schemes.
Taub says the new financial reform bill could change the insider trading game. Among other things, it includes provisions to oversee hedge funds much more rigorously. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Well, the housing data we've gotten so far this week have shown some evidence of an improving housing market, but things remain well below the levels economists consider to be healthy. For more, let's bring in Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. He's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Chris, why is the housing market still stuck even as the rest of the economy seems to recover?
The housing market is in a depression, and prices are still coming down. In fact, the price declines have accelerated over the past 3 months. Hmm. And by the way, Jeremy, who wants to buy a home? Who wants to put money into anything if you know the price is going to continue to go down?
Yeah.
So people sit on the sidelines. And what's driving the prices down? It's mostly foreclosures, short sales, people needing to walk away from their homes. And about 27% of homes have negative equity or near negative equity. And these are the type of properties that might go into foreclosure, might go into short sale.
27%. And Chris, obviously, there's a lot of uncertainty in Washington as well about what's going to happen to the mortgage deduction, what's going to happen to Fannie and Freddie. How is that figuring into people's calculations about buying and selling houses?
Washington is a dead weight on the housing market. Mm. Mortgage lenders have tightened their standards. So it's a lot harder to qualify for a mortgage these days. And one of the reasons is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they've tightened their standards. So it's spilled over. And then there's, as you mentioned, there's all the uncertainty about what's the future of these two giant institutions that have been so important to this market and supporting the market. And then as the whole discussion about the budget deficit goes ahead, in the coming months,
yep.
I got to tell you, that mortgage interest deduction is going to be a big point.
Absolutely. Now, what could possibly put some upward pressure on the housing market?
I think it's a combination of two things. First of all, homes haven't been this affordable for 40 years. So, that news is going to get out there. And then when people feel more comfortable taking a risk, and here's my standard, it's mostly jobs. People are getting jobs. Unemployment rate goes down. That's a good thing. But even more important, when people feel comfortable to take the risk to leave their current employer, they're going to be comfortable taking the risk to buy a home.
Always comes back to jobs. Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
General Electric beat expectations this morning with a quarterly profit more than 70% higher than in the same quarter last year. GE is focusing more on its industrial business and less on the financial arm, GE Capital.
The number of people filing for first-time jobless benefits dropped last week to 403,000. The numbers have been bouncing up and down right around that level for several months.
And you can bounce around our website. Check out the numbers section at marketplace.org.
And Steve, what if people are annoyed or delighted by anything on the podcast? Delighted. How can they get in touch
with us? They're never delighted. They're always annoyed.
No, come on.
That's not true at all. Well, you can, of course, tweet us. I'm on Twitter at Radio Chio.
And I'm on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson.
You can also go to marketplace.org and click on Contact.
This podcast is supported by FreshBooks, the easy professional online invoicing service made especially for small businesses. Learn more at FreshBooks.com.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. Italy's Fiat today confirmed it's going to buy into more of American carmaker Chrysler, putting its stake at 46%.
Now, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London, and he has more on that story this morning. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So why is Fiat doing this?
Well, Fiat already has 30% of Chrysler, which it acquired since the company emerged from Chapter 11 2 years ago. Fiat's running Chrysler at the moment, and it wants to own it, as you say, before the end of the year. Fiat wants to become a much bigger company, and it wants greater access to the all-important U.S. market, where historically Fiat hasn't had much of a presence.
So what is it going to mean if Chrysler is Italian-owned?
Well, Chrysler would undoubtedly benefit from Fiat's expertise in making smaller economy cars. Here's David Bailey of Coventry University Business School.
This could actually help Chrysler in the sense that they've had a pretty poor track record on developing fuel-efficient small cars. Chrysler can't really do that on its own. It needs another partner, whether to develop cars with jointly or whether it has a bigger owner with deeper pockets.
So is it a foregone conclusion then, Stephen? Will Chrysler be taken over?
David Bailey thinks so, yes, because the deal makes good industrial and economic sense, he says. He says it's difficult to see Chrysler surviving on its own. But this is going to be a bit of a psychological blow for the US, one of the big three car makers falling under the control of a foreign company.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Well, British oil giant BP has filed suit against its oil rig partners Transocean and Halliburton, saying negligence contributed to last year's Gulf of Mexico oil disaster. Meanwhile, more than a year later, shrimping season is once again underway this week in Louisiana, and a new marketing effort could help fishermen lure some new customers. Marketplace's Eve Cho reports.
Multiple hurricanes have hit the port of Delcom, Louisiana. So has competition from cheap imported seafood. And the BP oil spill hurt its image. Only a dozen or so shrimp boats hang on. Terrell Melanson has one.
It's been a family, about 45 years. It's been handed down from my father.
He stands on the deck, deeply tanned in jeans and a T-shirt, and telltale shrimper footwear, tall white rubber boots.
Yes, ma'am, yes. Some Cajun Reeboks.
Next to him is Thomas Emel, who does outreach with fishermen for Louisiana State University.
So this is an old-time Cypress hull, huh?
This is the old Cypress hull. This is the oldest boat in Port of Delcom.
Emel collects details like this for a website, portofdelcom.com. He writes profiles of local fishermen and updates on what they catch. Email says they won't go on Facebook or Twitter.
But now look, they will call you. This morning I got a call from Jimmy Dupre on the T-Turbo. Hey, Tom, I got shrimp.
So email immediately posts what kind of shrimp the boat caught and when it'll be in port. Customers get an email or text message, then call the fisherman, Jimmy Dupre.
Hello.
While he's still on the boat.
Yeah, we're out in the bay right now. Me and my wife and my grandson paid $325 a pound for the big one. Most of my customers want big shrimp.
Shrimpers make 2 to 3 times more money this way. The port is opening the website to other seafood. Economist Alex Miller works with fishermen around the Gulf. He says there's a feel-good factor, too.
Consumers really want to know where their seafood came from, and they want to know the story.
He's helping customers all around the country meet fishermen virtually. He plans to put tags on Gulf seafood that customers can scan with a smartphone or look up online. They'll see who caught their fish, where, and when it was tested for toxins.
And know that it passed with flying colors, and hey, this is a safe product to eat.
He says right now, there's no such thing as too much information about Gulf seafood. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Well, now to Russia, where Prime Minister Vladimir Putin told his nation's parliament the country is emerging powerfully, that's his word, from the global financial crisis. But a population decline, he says, is holding the country back economically. So Putin announced a more than $50 billion initiative aimed at turning that around. From Moscow, reporter Peter Van Dyke has more.
Russians are big drinkers and smokers, and they die young, at least compared to people in other wealthy countries. They also have fewer children. James Nixie is at the Chatham House think tank in London.
You know, the demographic situation is so difficult, it's like turning around an oil tanker. It just cannot be done immediately, and it possibly can't even be done at all.
The government already pays Russians to have more children, but now Prime Minister Vladimir Putin says it will do more. Once, a Russian official even offered rewards to couples who gave birth on Russia Day. 9 months before the holiday, he declared Family Contact Day, encouraging husbands and wives to be friendly.
So I think it's a situation which goes beyond chucking money at it and, you know, having national sex days and all that kind of rubbish.
The government knows that, and it is trying to get Russians to take better care of themselves. The last person who tried that banned alcohol sales, but it didn't go very well. His name was Mikhail Gorbachev. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, typically we look to Silicon Valley for innovation.
Yes, we do.
They seem to come out with all kinds of gadgets here and there, but no more is that necessary. Now it's innovation is as close as your neighborhood 7-Eleven.
What?
The convenience store chain is introducing some exciting new Slurpee technology this summer.
Oh, man.
According to USA Today, 7-Eleven is rolling out Slurpee cups with dual chambers, a special valve, and 2 straws.
Dual chambers?
Why would they need to do that? Well, here's why. The idea is that the 2 Slurpee flavors that you have in the cup in these dual chambers won't actually come together until the instant before they reach your tongue.
Wow. It's like a flux capacitor. The lightning has to strike at the precise time that you're going 88 miles an hour.
It's a slurps capacitor.
A As we continue on now with the Marketplace Midday Update, let's check in on sports. Major League Baseball has taken over the day-to-day operations of the Los Angeles Dodgers. The league says a cash shortage has affected team performance and Dodger Stadium security. Now, historically, few teams of any sport have been taken over by their leagues, so this has some pretty big ramifications. And Marketplace's Janet Babin is with us this morning to talk about it. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning, Steve.
How is it a league can come in and just usurp the owner and the executive director just like that?
Yeah, leave it to sports, right? In the rarefied diamond of baseball, the league commissioner can swoop in and take over a team. The league just has to invoke its special powers in the name of whatever's in the best interests of baseball. It famously did this in the 90s. It suspended Yankees owner George Steinbrenner, and it's moved against other owners, too. But this action is more radical. It really would take pretty much all power away from Dodgers owner Frank McCourt.
So is this temporary, Janet?
Well, it seems to be temporary, and the league's going to have to come in and take on some expenses of the Dodgers, going to have to meet payroll. Now, Frank McCourt will try to fight the league on this, but I spoke to Eric Fisher with Sports Business Journal about this, and he says for McCourt, this is like he's in the bottom of the ninth with two outs.
He's just so heavily leveraged in debt, he just doesn't have the money to basically buy his way out of these problems right now.
Long term, the league will absolutely have to find a new owner to buy the team.
All right. Marketplace's Janet Babin. Thanks, Janet.
Thank you.
All right. More sports now, Steve. Sacramento is trying to hold on to its pro basketball team, and the city will get one more desperation shot in the next couple of days. The owners of the NBA Kings are in talks to move their franchise from Sacramento right down here to Anaheim.
Mm-hmm.
But first, league officials are taking a close look at what the mayor of California's capital city says he's got lined up, millions of dollars in new business commitments to keep the team in Sacramento. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
To find out what the fuss is about, I spoke to a Stanford University economist who studied the financial impact of sports teams, and Professor Roger Noll told me, follow the money.
Arenas and stadiums for football and baseball as well have grown bigger and bigger without adding seats.
He says the new venues have become shopping malls for team concessions, and they cater to business bigwigs with lucrative skyboxes. For one thing, Sacramento doesn't play host to any Fortune 500 headquarters, and Anaheim has 50 more luxury suites than Sacramento's aging arena. He says the skybox money flows to the owners, but no matter which California city gets the team next year, Noll says the average fan won't add much to the local economy.
If they spend more on basketball, it's because they'll be spending less on doing other things in entertainment and recreation and other kinds of discretionary expenditures. So as a result, the net effect on the economy is zero.
Still, I asked the Stanford professor, try putting a value on the civic pride of being a big league city.
$4.24.
Okay. It's an interesting question, Noll explains, but not really one for an economist. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, a robot threw out the first pitch last night at the Phillies-Brewers baseball game in Philadelphia. They're replacing people with robots all over. Forget about, just technologically where, they're not. I mean, robots are making cars now and all that.
Yeah.
Now they're throwing out the
now
first pitch
are,
of the baseball
yeah,
game, right?
The
mechanical hurler is a creation of a couple of University of Pennsylvania students. Its name? PhillyBot. Okay, it was at the Phillies game last night in Philadelphia. But PhillyBot didn't have a glowing debut, Jeremy. It only managed a 40-mile-an-hour bouncer that came up short. A bouncer, man, that came up short of home plate. And the Phillies fans booed him.
Win one, lose one, right? Because the robots beat us in Jeopardy, so it's only fair that we still can hold some sway over
there.
The robots.
Some sway, certainly some sway there.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Thursday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.